the letter G, and the number 20. Therein, for the moment anyway, lies the global economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday today, the 28th of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So look, let's do this. Let's just put today's program on hold, okay? Till President Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping have their meeting over at the G20 in Osaka, Saturday morning, Japan time. It's only going to be another five, maybe six more hours we'll have to wait, because honestly, a whole lot of what's going to happen in this economy and in China's economy in the short and medium term kind of depends on what happens at that meeting. Radio deadlines being what they are, though, we do kind of have to keep going. So we will do that on this Friday with Soumaya Keynes from The Economist, Kate Davidson from The Wall Street Journal. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hi. Soumaya, let me start with you I guess ask you to test my premise. I exaggerate for effect, but there's a lot riding on this G20 meeting, yeah?
Yeah, there is rather a lot riding on it. This is the big one. So there has been progress in negotiations between China and America has stalled. There was a big falling out a little while ago, and this is the meeting where they decide whether things can get back on track. And if they can't, then that means tariffs of 25% on around $300 billion worth of imports. That would not be great for consumers in America, for business confidence, for all sorts of things.
Well, Kate, with that being the sword hanging over hanging over everybody's head, what do you think is going to happen?
Well, I think that it's really hard to say, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that some corporate lobbyists are hoping that the talks can produce a plan to finish negotiations by a specific deadline. So it's not as though they're going to come out of a meeting with some kind of plan, right? But the hope is that they will agree to resume talks in a meaningful way. That is, you know, sort of setting a firmer timeline. Both sides are under pressure here to deliver something. And presumably, you know, if there is some kind of sign of progress, President Trump would refrain from moving ahead with tariffs during that time period. I think that that's the hope. You know, there's other benefits. Like a ceasefire on trade could give the two sides momentum and like a possible path to sort out a number of other issues, right? You know, China's hold on the South China Sea and the U.S.'s campaign against Chinese technology firms, you know, like Huawei, over security concerns. So there are other things riding on this as well.
Soumaya, talk to me for a second. I mean, we kind of have a sense of what President Trump has going on here in terms of what's on the line for him, right? Economic expansion and jobs and domestic growth here. Talk to me about Xi Jinping, would you, though, and what he's got at risk?
Yeah, so the Chinese have a really complicated situation. So first of all, you've got this internal battle politically. So you have a group of reformers who wanted to almost take advantage of the pressure from the Trump administration to get through some kind of liberalization. And then you have the hardliners, the hawks, who are very worried about China, you know, being seen to be pressured by the Trump administration to have the Americans undermine their sovereignty and to make them look weak. Right. So Xi Jinping has got to, you know, weigh up those two and make sure that the political blowback, the political fallout isn't too great. Obviously, economically, the Chinese economy is going through a dicey time. They're trying to deleverage. There's a lot of debt swilling around that economy. And if growth falters, then achieving that becomes more difficult.
Yeah. So, Kate, last thing on this, and then I want to move on. But put this all in the context of a global economy, which, as Soumaya alluded to, is slowing. Certainly in China, our economy is showing some signs. There is some peril.
Yes, there is. I think if we're thinking about it through the lens of just U.S. policymakers, trade is really the biggest uncertainty right now. We have the Fed thinking about whether they need to cut interest rates. They've signaled pretty strongly that they'd be willing to do that in the coming months if the trade tensions worsen. So you said there's a lot riding on this. I think that officials over at the Fed will be paying close attention to developments this weekend. They're going to be meeting again at the end of July. Fed Chairman Jerome Powell was asked at his last press conference, if there was a trade deal, would that take a rate cut off the table? he said not necessarily, but it all feels very intertwined. So I think, the next several months depend greatly on what happens this weekend.
Well, so Sumaya, let's keep going with that intertwined theme in the last minute or so we have. And you've been reporting on a story this afternoon. The European Union has made a deal with a South American trading bloc, largely as a way to go to President Trump and say, we got other options.
Yeah, I think so this was announced today, big news in the trade geek world, that after 20 years, the EU has finally agreed this trade deal with Mercosur. That's Argentina, Brazil, Paraguay and Uruguay. So that's the biggest market that they've agreed a trade deal with. So the EU is obviously very excited. It's not going to be the deepest deal in the world. This deal probably isn't going to light the global economy on fire, but it does matter politically. This is the right. EU saying to Donald Trump, if you threaten us, we've got other friends, we're going to be moving ahead without you.
We shall see. Kate Davidson at the Wall Street Journal, Samaya Keynes at The Economist. Thanks, you two, on a Friday.
Thank you.
All right, have a nice weekend. With today's session, by the way, on Wall Street, we do bring the first half of trading of 2019 to a close. Pretty good 6 months, TBH. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, so Kate was talking about the Fed there a minute or two ago. We are going to dig in a little bit now to the offensive that President Trump's got going against the Federal Reserve, and specifically against the chairman that he himself appointed, Jay Powell. We all know the president wants lower interest rates to goose the stock market and boost economic growth. But last week, he gave, in a tweet, of course, another rationale that other countries' central banks are driving down the value of their currencies in order to stimulate their economies, and that he, the president, wants the Fed to do the same. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour explains the economics and the policy realities the president seems not to grasp.
The president wants a weaker dollar, and he wants the Federal Reserve to help him get it by lowering interest rates.
If you cut interest rates and other countries aren't cutting theirs, money tends to leave.
Ian Shepherdson is chief economist with Pantheon Macroeconomics. When interest rates go down in one country more than another, investors will pick their money up out of that country and stick it somewhere else where they can get a better interest rate.
Money wants a home where it's going to get paid more.
That drives down the value of a country's currency. But that's not why the Fed sets interest rates.
Fed officials never talk about the exchange rate.
Vincent Reinhardt is chief economist at Mellon. Why don't they? Because managing the U.S. dollar is literally not the Fed's job. The Fed's actual job, by law, is to ensure two things.
Maximum employment and stable prices.
Get people jobs and keep prices under control. Managing those things can affect the dollar, but inflation and jobs are the priority. All that said, while the Fed can't target the dollar, the Treasury could. It could go into international currency markets and buy or sell dollars, pushing the value up or down. It could do that, but it doesn't. Brad Setzer is with the Council on Foreign Relations.
The really big G7 central banks over the past 10 years have basically agreed among themselves to take exchange rate intervention off the table.
Because it's expensive, for one, and the world's most developed economies didn't want to start fighting over exchange rates. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Open offices. All the rage the past decade or so, those wall-less, doorless, in theory, airy hives of worker productivity, people seated cheek by jowl along big communal tables, they've become a favorite punching bag for frustrated workers who blame them for everything from spreading the flu to cranking up anxiety. Well, there's a new survey from the HR research firm Future Workplace that shows people are actually evenly split in their preference for an open office floor plan, and the difference seems to come down to how well somebody can deal with noise and distraction. From our Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more on how workers are surviving a world without walls.
Office design trends come and go, reflecting shifting tastes and the values of their time. From the cushy, closed-door executive suites of the post-war Mad Men era,
please shut the door and have a seat,
to the soulless monotony of cubicle farms lambasted in the movie Office Space.
I gotta get out of here. I think I'm gonna lose it.
Our current obsession with open offices is in many ways a reaction to those environments, says Karen Dillon, author of the Harvard Business Review Guide to Office Politics.
There's almost like a management backlash that's now playing itself out. We've allowed people too much independence, or they don't collaborate enough, or we need innovation.
The open office, where employees are forced to congregate in a democratized communal space, has been billed as a way to enhance collaboration, to build relationships through spontaneous interactions that inspire trust and creativity. Plus, they look cool.
For sure, the open office looks great in pictures. You know, you put up some cool-looking posters and maybe paint the walls a color that really pops, and it gives a feeling like your company is really hip and cool.
Roland Dreyer is a software engineer for a data storage company in the heart of Silicon Valley, where the craze for the open office was born. He says back when his company was a scrappy startup with a couple dozen employees, it allowed the growing business to save on overhead, stay nimble, and reinforce the feeling they were doing things differently.
Kind of sitting around in a small space with close colleagues and talking all the time, I think that was really effective.
At first, since those early days, they've added thousands of employees, expanded from one room into multiple buildings, and the open floor plan doesn't quite work the same.
You just kind of end up with a jumble of people distracting each other.
A growing body of research shows that, surprise, having a bunch of people in one place with no walls leads to a lot of noise and distraction. Everything from overhearing personal phone calls to loud chewers, chatty Cathys, nail clippers, you get the idea. Not exactly conducive to sustained concentration and productivity.
It's kind of like being in a zoo sometimes.
Christopher Oliver works in sales for an electrical equipment manufacturer in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, where he doesn't even have an assigned seat. He keeps his belongings in a locker and floats from desk to desk, booking different workstations through an app. He says his attention has likewise begun to wander.
It's like, oh, cool, what are they talking about, you know? It's just like, you know, a dog seeing a squirrel. You know, you just listen to everything and look at everything.
When Oliver needs to focus, he turns to what has become the go-to survival tool of the open office worker, headphones. Not only for their ability to drown out external sound, but, Karen Dillon says, for what they say to your coworkers.
When people see the headphones on, it sends a signal to people that I'm working or I'm engaged or I'd rather not be interrupted.
The need to disconnect from the chaos this way can create barriers, though. Research suggests workers in open offices are less likely to speak to each other face-to-face, relying on Slack or email instead. But the Future Workplace survey found groups who are more likely to use headphones to create personal space, like millennials and Gen Z, did have a more positive impression of open offices. Roland Dreyer says he turns up the classical music and podcasts on his headset.
Most streaming services now seem to have playlists that are geared towards people trying to focus.
Though they probably don't include Christopher Oliver's chosen soundtrack.
I listen to metal, you know, double pedal drums and screamy metal, and that kind of just puts me in my happy zone.
Sounds more like the angry zone to me, but whatever gets you through the day. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Think about it as paying to never have to have this conversation ever again.
Okay, I'm in. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 73 points today, 0.2%, 26,599. The NASDAQ added 38 points, about 0.4%, 8,006. The S&P 500 found 16 points in the couch cushions, 0.5%, 29,041. For the week, the Dow down 0.4%, the NASDAQ down 0.3%, as was the S&P 500. But the major indices up sharply for the month, and as I said, today's session marked the end of the first half of the year for stocks. The S&P up more than 17%.
for 2019. Shares in big banks rose after they all passed the Fed's annual stress tests. JPMorgan Chase and Citigroup lifted 2.7% today. Secondhand luxury clothing and accessories retailer, actually their consignment store, The RealReal, soared 44% today on its IPO. The RealReal, as I said, does consignment that sells high-end brands like Gucci and Louis Vuitton. Has a couple of brick-and-mortar stores, too. We had the CEO on the program about a year and a half. You can check that out at marketplace.org. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.0%. You're listening to Marketplace. And as we approach the end of Marketplace's budget year, we're doing some numbers of our own. Part of being a responsible news organization, especially one that covers business and the economy, is fiscal responsibility. And we've got a target we need to hit by June 30th. We are closing in on our goal of 2,500 Marketplace investors for this drive, but we still do need to hear from you. Even a gift of just $5 will make a difference. So please donate today at marketplace.org. And thanks.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Homeowners among you, wannabe homeowners too, probably, will know and perhaps will love the Zestimate, Zillow's tool for estimating home value. Until not too long ago, though, Zillow's algorithms had a big limitation. They could make a pretty good guess based on comparable sales and square footage and all the rest of that, but they couldn't actually see your home. The company announced this week the Zestimate will now analyze pictures to try to capture nuances like natural light and curb appeal. Marketplace's Amy Scott has that one.
Yes, Zillow's computers are going to look at photos, but they're not going to know whether your kitchen has granite or formica countertops. The company's director of economic research, Skylar Olson, says they don't need to.
What the computer does know is I see a picture in terms of an array of pixels. And when I observe certain patterns are more associated with high sale prices in a region, then I'm scoring those patterns that I see as higher valued patterns.
So, for example, a bright pattern in a kitchen photo where the sunlight pours in might bump up the Zestimate a little bit. Nuances like that can also increase accuracy. And Rick Palacios Jr. with John Burns Real Estate Consulting says with competition from Redfin and other online estimators, accuracy is everything.
Continuously improving on that draws more attention to your site.
The images will come from sellers, realtors, and Google Maps for exteriors. Debbie Wong is a broker in the San Francisco Bay Area. She says photos, though, don't always show the whole picture.
Photos speak 1,000 words, but sometimes it's speaking a language that you might not necessarily want out there, you know, in the internet.
Like if the Google Street View car drove by your house on trash day. You can request photos be removed and upload your own, which is likely to boost the real estate photography business. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Marvel is re-releasing Avengers Endgame today. Yes, that Avengers Endgame, the one that originally opened back in late April. This time around, though, moviegoers will see some extra footage after the credits, including a deleted scene and a sneak peek of the new Spider-Man movie. No, re-releases aren't new, but Marvel is doing this one really quickly. Marketplace's Mariel Segura explains what's going on.
After 22 Marvel movies, Captain America, Iron Man, Black Widow, and all your favorite superheroes have another mission. Avengers Endgame has made more than $2.7 billion worldwide, which means it is only about $40 million away from becoming the highest-grossing movie of all time.
We're the Avengers. We gotta finish this.
The number one movie is Avatar from 2009. Rob Keyes at ScreenRant.com says this re-release to almost 2,000 theaters is about breaking that record.
what they're offering in terms of like newness, like new footage at the end, it's really not that much. It's more of a marketing ploy to kind of get more people in theaters so they can push it a little further at the box office so they can beat the Avatar world record.
This could be an easy win for Marvel. Keyes says the re-release isn't going to cost the studio that much. Post-production wasn't even finished on that deleted scene, and the movie itself will stay the same. And Paul Hardart at the NYU Stern School of Business says it helps that Marvel has a loyal fan base.
They've already got the brand equity built in. People know about it, so they don't have to spend that much more incremental marketing costs. So it's really very smart.
The question is, will it work? I mean, these extras are the kind of thing you might see in a DVD release. Who's going to go back to the theater to see them? 28-year-old Daniel Bokelman will.
I'm fairly impatient with these kinds of things. I always hate knowing that there's something, you know, new and I haven't seen it.
Bokelman didn't even like the movie that much, says the female superheroes didn't get enough screen time. The big Marvel fan is hoping for some resolution from that deleted scene. Other fans aren't going for the extras. For them, this is personal. Avatar's director, James Cameron, made some snide comments about Marvel movies in an interview last year. So 29-year-old Tracy Yang says she wants to help Marvel smash Avatar's record.
As a fan who's spoken to a lot of other Marvel fans, like, we're happy to deliver on that.
By the way, both Avatar and Avengers Endgame are owned by Disney. So Disney could get the bragging rights of breaking its own record and the profits, too. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
Consider for just a moment the work we all do in our lives. There's the paid kind, and then there's the not paid kind. And therein, oftentimes, in that not paid work world lies some tension. Take as our example today how to manage a household. Everybody's got their own system, right? Rima Kreis, the host of our new podcast, This Is Uncomfortable, about life and how money messes with it, has the story of a couple that found an unusual way to make housework feel fair.
Curtis Staples and Alexis Kirk had been dating for exactly a year when they decided to move in together.
You know, I feel like you get to know someone on a different level when you live with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, I feel like it was a good way to, like, get to know Curtis and learn all of his annoying secret habits before we got married.
What were some of those annoying secret habits?
Well, perfect segue, not washing the dishes.
It's the kind of thing people divorce over. No, like, seriously. Last year, this study from Harvard Business School found that a quarter of new divorces in the U.S. were over housework. And generally speaking, research shows partners who fight over this stuff are more likely to end their relationship. At first, Curtis and Alexis had it worked out. Curtis handled most of the housework and Alexis cooked. But after a few months of living together, it started getting dicey when it came to the dishes.
I can cook somewhat. I know how many dishes should be used. There was definitely more than there was supposed to be as far as I'm concerned. She will use like a spatula once, just stir the pot and then put it in the dirty dishes. And we go through like six spatulas a night.
And in my defense, I make gourmet meals and Curtis's cooking is like one pot of goulash. So yes, it takes one pot and one spoon.
Alexis would cook that big gourmet meal and Curtis would do the dishes, but just not right away. To him, it just made sense to wash the dishes every couple or even few days once they're all piled up. Alexis was not okay with that.
Yes. Every day, it was like the nagging thing where I'm like, oh, don't you want to come do these dishes before you sit down and watch TV? And Curtis is like, nope, I don't. I'll do them later.
Here we go again. Why can't y'all put your heads together and think of something to make everybody happy?
That's Alexis's mom, Denise. She would come over for dinner a couple times a week and was getting really tired of Alexis and Curtis bickering over the dishes every night. And frankly, the dishes were getting to her, too.
They're piled high. I mean, plates, bowls, spoons. Both sides of the sink would be full.
Do you remember one of the nastiest things you saw?
Probably oatmeal.
So finally, one night, Denise steps in as the voice of reason.
My mom was like, what is it worth to you to have Curtis do the dishes when you want them done mm-hmm. so that you guys don't have to fight about it anymore? It came down to, okay, I'm going to pay Curtis to do the dishes when I want them done.
Wait, what? Denise proposes that Alexis pay Curtis $100 each month to do the dishes. At first, Alexis refuses to even consider it.
Why should I have to pay Curtis to do something that he has said he's going to do anyway? Like, this is ridiculous.
Alexis's mom tells her she wouldn't actually be paying for Curtis to do the dishes when she wants. What she's actually paying for is sanity.
You know, my mom was like, think about it as paying to never have to have this conversation ever again.
She negotiates. She'll pay him $75 a month to get the dishes done when she wants, and she'll put them away once they're clean. According to that survey I mentioned before, when couples spend money to save time, like paying someone to clean, they had happier relationships. It's not exactly what Curtis and Alexis are doing here, but it's the same idea, finding a solution rooted in money to minimize a conflict.
You know, the money piece of it is not super important, but it's an agreement I can get behind.
Because it was such a black and white transactional relationship, it took the feelings and the emotion out of it. And so it no longer is, when we do talk about it, the discussion is no longer charged with emotion.
Yeah. It becomes more of a job, it sounds like.
Yeah.
You all, like, made it into a literal job, I guess, if you're getting paid.
It is a literal job.
And since then, they haven't fought about the dishes at all. Not even once. From the podcast This Is Uncomfortable, I'm Rima Khares for Marketplace.
I personally think $75 a month is a tad cheap. Don't at me on that one, but please do subscribe to This Is Uncomfortable. This final note on the way out today, it's an M&A deal that makes you go, what? On a whole bunch of levels, the Danish family behind Lego is teaming up with an American private equity firm to buy a company called Merlin Entertainment and take it private. Merlin owns, among other things, the Legoland theme parks, the London Eye, that big Ferris wheel thing over there, also Madame Tussauds wax museums. In other news, turns out Madame Tussauds is still a thing.
Hey, it's Molly Wood here, and you gotta listen to this week's Make Me Smart. This week, we're kicking off a new series on our show, all about the economics of inequality. And this episode is all about the widening pay gap between CEOs and workers. Some higher-ups are making 1,000 times or more their lowest-paid employees. So what does this mean for our economy and our society?
This is the most important economic issue that we're going to have to confront, because otherwise we're going to become a stale, some kind of aristocracy. I don't know what we'll call it, but it's calcifying wealth in ways that isn't going to be good for all of us.
Make Me Smart, because none of us is as smart as all of us. Find us wherever you podcast.
All right, we're going. Dow Industrials up 73 today, 0.2%. NASDAQ up 38 points, 0.4%. S&P 500, 16 points to the good, about 0.5%. Great 6 months, though, as I mentioned. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday. Everybody have a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.